Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and His kingdom. I want to start with a short mission brief that I think frames the issues that we're going to be talking about in a moment with our first guest. As Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been making his rounds of Western legislatures with virtual speeches to a joint session of Congress yesterday and the German Bundestag today, he seemed to have scored at least one potentially significant victory. President Biden has joined him in declaring Russian dictator Vladimir Putin a war criminal. The International Criminal Court has already opened an investigation into the ongoing and still intensifying crimes against humanity Putin is inflicting on innocent civilians, refugees, and others in Ukraine. At present, however, he seems unlikely to stand trial, let alone be punished. Putin's designation as a war criminal, however, could have an important knock-on effect, though. His ally, Communist China's Xi Jinping, must be put on notice. Those enabling Putin's crimes by violating international sanctions on Russian energy sales, resupplying the Kremlin's arsenal, etc., will be deemed accomplices and treated accordingly. I want to get into all of this with our first guest. His name is Congressman Chris Stort. He represents with great distinction the people of the 2nd District of Utah in the House of Representatives, where he serves, among other things, as a senior member of the House Intelligence Committee. He is a decorated veteran Air Force pilot, combat pilot, a best-selling author, and a successful entrepreneur. He's always a welcome guest here at Securing America. Chris, it's good to have you back, sir.
Great to be with you, Frank. You've been a friend for such a long time. Love what you do, and I'm a big fan, so thank you.
Well, thank you. It's entirely mutual. Let me ask you about Ukraine, sir. There is a very, well, earnest debate underway in conservative circles in particular as to whether or not Ukraine qualifies as a part of the free world. The argument being that it's been so corrupt, or that it's been for so long part of the Russian Empire or the Soviet one, that it really doesn't sort of qualify, since it's not a member of NATO, since it's not a member of the European Union, for that matter, as part of the West. And therefore, we should really have no interest in what is happening to it at the moment. What are your thoughts, sir?
Well, I think, Frank, it's like my kids like to say to me sometimes, Dad, it's complicated. And it really is a little bit complicated. I think the Ukrainian people have earned the respect and the right to be aligned with the West in the last month. I just don't think there's any question about that. When you see the courage that they displayed, when you see families taking their wives and their children to the border, and then the husbands or the sons going back to fight, when you see President Zelensky, as you've mentioned, and the courage that he has displayed, I think that demands respect from the West. And we need to acknowledge that and be accommodating to that. While at the same time, again, because it is complicated, I don't think Ukraine has met the threshold to be invited to NATO. I think it probably would have been a generation or more before they would have met that threshold, because, as you indicated, there's enormous corruption throughout the country, throughout the government, and there has been for as long as they've, as long as they've existed. I wish that wasn't so. I think that President Zelensky and some of their other leadership perhaps wishes that wasn't so. But it is a reality. And so we're trying to thread a needle here in the sense that you can't treat Ukraine the same way you would a NATO country. We simply just don't have the same treaty obligations with them. We don't have the same alliance, while at the same time recognizing, hey, these are people who do not want to live under the thumb of Vladimir Putin. They do not want to be aligned with a new Soviet Union or a new, you know, as Vladimir Putin rebuilds the former Warsaw Pact. They want to be aligned with the West. And I think we need to try to acknowledge that and facilitate that if we can.
It goes without saying that Vladimir Putin's regime is orders of magnitude more corrupt, I think, than Ukraine. So that's not a high bar, it seems to me, to qualify as, you know, better for sure and more pro-Western. But your impressions of Zelensky himself, you obviously heard him address the Congress yesterday, and the character of the support that we can and should be providing to him. I'm particularly interested in your experience as a combat pilot, as I mentioned, whether or not we have, in fact, a feasible option, let alone an advisable one, in trying to do a no-fly zone there.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly could. The U.S. military is capable of doing that, but we certainly should not. And I've been talking with my colleagues here in Congress, and in some cases with some friends who are senators as well, and helping them to recognize when you declare a no-fly zone, it doesn't mean that you just throw up a couple F-16s and now this is a no-fly zone and it's that simple. It's much, much more difficult than that. We enforced a no-fly zone over Iraq for years. And it's very complex. For example, Frank, as I think you understand, you have to take out all the surface-to-air missile sites. You have to take out all the AAA, command and control. You have to take out their radar sites. You have to do all of that before you actually put an aircraft in the air and now say, okay, now we're going to engage the Russian fighters. You've probably killed hundreds of Russian soldiers just prepping the battlefield to create and to enforce a no-fly zone. And then you have, of course, NATO or American pilots who are shooting down Russian pilots. And one other thing to recognize those as well, we'd be flying those American patrols out of probably Germany, but perhaps Poland. But those air bases are not going to be a safe haven. Vladimir Putin is going to say, if you're coming at me with your air power, I'm going to attack the source of that, which is, of course, the military base. So it's kind of like, I really actually don't like the analogy, but it's very adequate in this case, and that is, you can't be partway pregnant. You either are or you are not, and you cannot be partway at war with Russia. You either are or you are not. And the moment we say we're going to create and enforce a no-fly zone, at that moment, we are now at war with Russia, which is an outcome that many of us are trying to avoid for all sorts of reasons. We need to support Ukraine in appropriate ways. But we also need to temper down the emotion and as best we can de-escalate rather than now make it much more dangerous, not only to American security, but frankly, to just global security.
Well, the Congress has just enacted, as you know, I think another $14 billion or so in aid, a good portion of which, as I understand it, is going to be weapons, javelins and these anti-aircraft systems of various kinds, drones even, some of which are now on their way, we're told, to Ukraine. Are those the sorts of appropriate assistance that you're thinking of, Congressman Stewart? And is there anything else that you think ought to be in the mix, if not this no-fly zone, in terms of capabilities that won't be too escalatory and yet will help the Ukrainians defend their country?
Yeah, and again, there is great value, there's a moral argument, there's a practical argument, there's a military argument for opposing Vladimir Putin, that very clearly as he's gone into Ukraine. We can't just shrug our shoulders and act as if that doesn't matter. At the same time, we have to have the goal of not escalating this, not engaging the United States directly in a war with Russia. And so trying to thread that needle, as you've said, the Javelin missile systems, for example, I think they're the most critical, far and away the most important thing we could do for the Ukrainian military and the Ukrainian resistance. They've proven to be deadly to Russian army, and they're so easy to operate. They're just fascinating systems in the sense you could give them to a high schooler, and in 5 minutes they'd be effective at them.
And apparently that's been happening to some extent, and there is a decided impact on the advance of this Russian armor. Congressman, we have to take just a very quick break. When we come back, I want to wrap up that thought, and then I want to turn with you to another issue that both of us are very concerned about, and that is communist China and both its takeaways from all of this and whether we are going to be able to deter yet another act of aggression, perhaps against Taiwan or India or both, by the Chinese Communist Party. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. As Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky continued making his rounds of Western legislatures with virtual speeches to a joint session of Congress yesterday and the German Bundestag today, he seemed to have scored at least one potentially significant victory. President Biden has joined him in declaring Russian dictator Vladimir Putin a war criminal. The International Criminal Court has already opened an investigation into the ongoing and still intensifying crimes against humanity Putin is inflicting on innocent civilians, refugees, and others in Ukraine. At present, however, he seems unlikely to stand trial, let alone be punished. Putin's designation as a war criminal, however, could have an important knock-on effect, though. His ally, Communist China's Xi Jinping, must be put on notice. Those enabling Putin's crimes by violating international sanctions on Russian energy sales, resupplying the Kremlin's arsenal, etc., will be deemed accomplices and treated accordingly. This is Frank Gaffney.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're continuing a really important conversation with one of the most influential members of the House of Representatives, a member of its Intelligence Committee. His name is Representative Chris Stort of Utah. And Congressman, you were talking a bit about the kinds of weapon systems, in addition to the Javelin, the Stingers that have been effective against at least low-flying aircraft. Is that another of these systems that you think is warranted? And what else should be in the mix in the hardware side of the military kind? And when you talk about escalation, is there a concern that what we're doing on the economic side is really full-on war with the Russians that might be seen by Putin as pretty escalatory in itself?
Oh my gosh, Frank, there's a lot to unpackage in your question, and I hope we have an hour, but I don't think we do. So let me try to be very brief. Number one is the economic escalation is something that we have to be sensitive to, because there you may reach a point where almost a point of no return on that. It's already going to take years for the Russians to, if they were to perhaps, let's say that they withdrew from Ukraine tomorrow. Still, the implications of this will be with them for years. Right. And I think the economic sanctions are one of the most valuable tools we have. But again, we need to be thoughtful in how we implement those. The second thing you mentioned is, the military hardware. You're exactly right. I think that the Javelin, the Stingers, obviously just a continual supply of ammunition. My concern isn't so much that we're giving them the right things, because I think that we have, but we need to make it sustainable. We need to make sure that they don't run out of these weapons and these systems we've given them. And then last thought I want to mention on this, and I'll do it briefly, but I think it's important. And that is, we should have been doing this 4 months ago. I mean, Frank, you remember the President of the United States went to the American people, he went to Vladimir Zelensky, he went to NATO, and he said definitively that Putin is going to invade Ukraine. If he believed that, and he did, he should have been taking the opportunity then to arm them, to help prepare them. It's so much harder now that we have to slip it across the border, material is subject to attack from Russia, as we've seen in the last few days. Oh my gosh, I wish we'd done it 4 months ago, 3 months ago, instead of trying to do it now.
And it's a perfect segue to the next topic that I wanted to turn to with you, Congressman, and that is the lesson here is, as you say, it would have been far preferable to deter this aggression in the first place. My personal assessment is Biden was hoping that Zelensky would surrender, and that's why he was talking up the threat so much, not that he was trying to warn them, but to persuade them to give up. But we're now looking at the possibility, and I'd like your thoughts on this, sir, as to whether or not China is taking away from all of this the idea that, forget about it, the attack on Taiwan, let's say, is simply going to be too costly, too difficult. We'll run into economic sanctions and so on our side. We don't want that. Or whether, in fact, perhaps for internal reasons, Xi Jinping, the Chinese dictator, Putin's counterpart, is going to be saying, well, I need to rally around the flag, my folks, I'm going to go for it and see what I can do to take advantage of the distractedness of the West and, frankly, Joe Biden's infirmities to see what I can do to get away with a longstanding objective of my country and thereby guarantee my third term. Again, a lot to unpack there too, sir, but what are your thoughts as to the lessons that should be learned and where do you think China goes from here?
Yeah, again, and that is really the question, isn't it? Because look, Vladimir Putin, short of him launching 2,000 nuclear missiles, is not going to destroy the United States. I think in 10 years, we're not going to be worried about Vladimir Putin. We're going to be worried about the existential threat of our future, which is China. And so we do have to ask those series of questions that you did. And honestly, they're unknowable. Some of them, at least, are unknowable. We can't get into the mind of President Xi. But we do know this. As you said, he's up for re-election. He has to have the support of the elites around him. And that is never assured when you're a dictator. They could lose that support at any time. The other thing I would say is this idea of reuniting Taiwan, it isn't just a feel-good thing to them. They consider it an essential part of their future. And as you said again, Frank, look, they went into Hong Kong. They took Hong Kong because we were so diverted with the coronavirus. They did that without anyone noticing at all. I mean, there wasn't so much as a hiccup from the West when they took Hong Kong. And so I think they thought, well, we can do Taiwan at the same time while they're diverted with Ukraine. I actually think, though, and this is my personal view, that the opposite argument is actually in play right now. And that is China is looking at this united front from the West. They're looking at these severe sanctions. And I don't think it dissuades them from taking Taiwan at some point, but it certainly has given them pause. And it probably has said to them, we need to prepare economically in ways we probably didn't anticipate we would have to. And that may take them a little bit of time. Does it stop them from going into Taiwan? I don't think it will. Does it make them think, yeah, this is going to be harder and more complicated, again, especially from the economic side, than we maybe anticipated? Because I think they were thinking, hey, this is going to be like Hong Kong. No one's going to say anything. I don't think they feel that way any longer. And they realize that it's going to take some preparation to anticipate the economic sanctions and how they would deal with them.
Yeah. Well, let's hope so. In the meantime, and let me just say, Congressman, one of the things that I've admired so much about your service to our country is not only what you've done in uniform, but also your work on the House Intelligence Committee and on the House China Task Force that was stood up, unfortunately, without Democratic support, which I would have hoped for, but I know you all worked to try to achieve. But you laid out a pretty impressive array of recommendations as to what we should be doing now about China. And I think, you know, enhancing deterrence on Taiwan is one part of that. Obviously, enhancing our ability to use various economic instruments to counter the Chinese predations was another. A very important part of this, though, and I just would be fascinated with your assessment of how you and your colleagues look at this, is we have an awful lot of Americans in the business elite, in particular, the financial sector most especially, who really see no problem migrating, well, not just technology and know-how and various industrial capabilities to China and supply chains, but also billions and billions and billions of our money, pension funds and investment funds and the like. What needs to be done about that kind of support for this mortal enemy of ours, whether they come after Taiwan immediately or not?
Yeah, I mean, the work we did on the China Task Force is some of the most important work. It's one of the things that I'm most proud of my time here in Congress. And you're right, we did try to get many of our Democratic colleagues. Nancy Pelosi would not allow them to. What a mistake. But the truth is that many of them support the ideas, the recommendations from the task force. And they should. Many of them are bipartisan. But, you know, and this will sound perhaps overly dramatic, and I hope it doesn't, but I'm convinced it's true. And that is, Abraham Lincoln and Ronald Reagan, among others, have said, no foreign nation will ever destroy this country. The only way we fall is if we commit national suicide. And there's no better example of that. There is no better example of that than what you just indicated there. Our willingness to give technology, to give military power, to give capabilities in financial markets and financial instruments willingly to the Chinese, as if there were no repercussions from that. And one of the really deep studies we did, and some of the most important recommendations, deal in financial services. It deals with what you've talked about there. For heaven's sakes, why in the world would we endow China with this type of power over our own markets, over our own economy, over our own ability to do financial services and banking around the world? And we've done it because people simply love money more than they love their own country. And shame on people, these very powerful people here in America who recognize what they're doing, but they just continue to do it because they're making so much money at it.
Chris, it's bad enough that you're right. We've ceded a lot of control and influence over the financial sector to the Chinese Communist Party. And that translates, as you know better than anybody, into influence over you and not so much you, obviously, but your colleagues, certainly, in political life in this country, not just at the federal level, but, you know, the governors and on down. And my question, I guess, is this, very quickly, if you would. Can we afford to ignore the national security implications of this kind of behavior? And if not, what very quickly should we be doing about it?
Well, and that's why it's so important that we take the House back in 2022 so that we can have these formal investigations, so we can have hearings, so we can hold people accountable, including people in the executive, to state the obvious, and their families. We have to understand what some of those connections are. And that's one of the great the things I most look forward to when we take the House back.
Well, this from your lips to God's ears, Congressman, we need that kind of inquiry and the accountability that hopefully will flow from it. Thank you, Chris Stewart, for joining us. Come back to us again soon, if you would. We're going to talk next to the great Carol Swain. She is going to visit with us about critical race theory and its implications for all of us right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. She is Dr. Carol Swain, one of America's most thoughtful and formidable public intellectuals. She's, among many other things, the host of Conversations with Dr. Carol Swain. She's the president of Be the People Project, and the author, most recently, of Black Eye for America. Dr. Swain, it's great to have you back. Welcome once again to Securing America.
Thank you.
I had Elaine Donnelly of the Center for Military Readiness on yesterday, and she described in, I'm afraid, alarming detail. What is happening to the United States military as a result of the effort to impose, well, what's been called critical race theory on our armed forces? The impact on the sort of division of our troops along racial lines, the impact that obviously has on unit cohesion and morale and readiness. And I wanted to just touch base with you, Carol. You've spent an enormous amount of time assessing and warning about and trying to counter this phenomenon of, a Maoist racist agenda. And I don't know if you've looked at the military in particular, but I'm interested in your thoughts about what it's doing to our educational system, for one thing, but to our society more broadly, as well as our armed forces.
Well, Frank, you may remember that it wasn't too many years ago when we looked at the U.S. military as the example of a successful affirmative action where you did have diversity and inclusion and people being promoted by merit. And we felt like that of all the institutions in society, the U.S. military got it correct. While all of that has changed because the meaning of diversity, equity, and inclusion has changed, diversity is no longer about, you know, making sure you have people from different backgrounds and races included. It's about promoting groups that were historically disadvantaged and pushing down others that they feel don't deserve where they have attained. And inclusion is not about, you know, bringing in these people. It's about setting up little affinity groups where people will self-segregate. And equity is not about equal opportunity. It's about equal outcomes. And all of that is CRT, critical race theory, which is a critical theory that's rooted in postmodernism as well as Marxism. And that is what is influencing our military. And as far as military readiness, they're not ready for anything. They're only ready to party because it's not just critical race theory. It's critical queer theory, LGBT theory. And so the military is not a fighting force. It is a social engineering experiment.
Yeah. Obviously, there are an awful lot of men and women in uniform who think they're there to fight for their country, and indeed, that's what they volunteered to do. But what you're describing really is the agenda that's being imposed upon them. There's a fellow by the name of Bishop Garrison, who has been installed by the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, to oversee, you know, this sort of countering extremism sort of office that apparently is sort of at the core of enforcing this so-called diversity et cetera, you know, agenda. It's frightening that this is being done, but let's back the lens up a bit and just say what's happening in our schools is no less frightening. And yet we're told it's not actually being taught in these academic institutions, public schools and universities and so on. Carol, you've spent most of your professional life in academia, either studying or, you know, teaching. Give us the straight story on how this agenda is being advanced in our academic institutions too.
Well, first of all, it's affecting every institution, every sector of our society. And I would say that it is to the detriment of our nation. We are not ready for anything. And our children can't compete with children around the world because it is in K through 12 education. And the political left has a pat answer when asked about CRT. Now they're saying, oh, that's a course that's taught in law school. That's a course that's taught at universities. And to that I say, yes and no. Yes, there are courses offered on critical theory at colleges and universities. But there's also critical theory is a worldview that its adherents have produced books, videos, teaching materials, and they have produced literature that affects even kindergarten. And some of these are civil rights books that are written from the perspective that demonizes all of white people, without showing the fact that during the civil rights movement, it was a multiracial coalition that cut across a religion that fought for civil rights in America. And the agenda of the critical theorists, it's all built around conflict theory, and it's built around racism, because it argues pretty much that all white people are racist and white supremacists because of the color of their skin, that only white people can be racist, that all minorities are victims of discrimination, and we know that that's not true. And it argues for segregation and lowered standards.
Right. This is so corrosive to a society like ours, and so terrifying, really, because it's working. The destructiveness, the dividing races or peoples of various kinds against one another, whether it's to the detriment of our fighting forces or, you know, our kids, for heaven's sakes, let alone everybody in between. Carol, a product of this whole diversity, inclusion, equity agenda seems to be the process whereby President Biden selected a nominee to be the next justice of the Supreme Court, associate justice of the Supreme Court, that is. Ketanji Brown Jackson is his nominee. She will be going before the United States Senate to be considered for this position next week. My hope would be that that you would be that nominee rather than her, but more to the point, that you would be called upon to testify about both the process whereby someone was clearly chosen not for the content of her character, but for the color of her skin and her gender, of course, as well. What does that mean for the law, for the court, for our process by which we move past these kind of issues of race and have once again pluribus unum and maybe on a higher scale than we ever have before?
Well, first of all, I've not been asked to testify. And if I had been asked to testify, I would have pointed out the fact that what we have is a political agenda where President Biden selected a nominee recommended by the most radical groups in America, including Black Lives Matter, that she is their candidate. And at a time when crime is escalating in America, pretty much they want to pick someone that wants to defund the police. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And I have problems with this process because the president, in announcing that he was only going to consider Black women, starts off by violating the Constitution because he's discriminating against all other groups. He's violating the U.S. Civil Rights law, as well as our Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. And he is selecting someone, you know, that she has the Ivy League degree, so she checks that box. She has Black skin, she's a woman, she checks that box. But when it comes to being connected with the American people, someone who will follow the law, there's no evidence that this person will, because she's wedded to an agenda. The other concern that I have is that there are at least two cases that will be heard by the Supreme Court in the fall that soon that have to do with affirmative action and voting rights. And if she is confirmed and placed on the court, you know, that will mean that you have someone that's not going to look at the Constitution and adhere to it and think about the statutory law. You have someone that is going to vote in a very predictable manner because she is appointed to advance a progressive agenda.
Yeah. And as you say, the fact that she was the strongly recommended candidate of people who have really made no secret, talk about Marxists, the Black Lives Matter organization founders are avowed practicing Marxists and destroying the courts, destroying the rule of law, destroying the Constitution, destroying the country, or, you know, their agenda. It's absolutely shocking that somebody like this would be advanced. Do you anticipate that she is going to be closely scrutinized on these grounds, Carol Swain?
I doubt it, and I keep hearing that they have the votes, and maybe the Democrats have the votes. I would certainly hope that Republicans would not join in supporting her. I think that the country would be better off if we must, you know, limit it to the three black women that the president said he looked at. My choice would have been the woman from South Carolina. I believe her name was Childers.
Yeah.
She was
passed over in favor of the Black Lives Matter candidate, alas. I hope that there's still time for you to testify on this nominee. But Carol, thank you for your testimony here. We appreciate so much your work and look forward to our next visit with you in the near future. Next up, we're going to have a conversation with the great Eric Metaxas about spiritual warfare in America and around the world. And are we, in fact, losing the good to the evil? That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. And I couldn't be more pleased to say a special welcome to Eric Metaxas, a good friend, a valued colleague, a number one New York Times bestselling author many times over for Bonhoeffer, Martin Luther, If You Can Keep It, and Amazing Grace, among others, and most recently, Is Atheism Dead? He's the host of the Eric Metaxas Show, a nationally syndicated daily radio program heard on some 300 outlets nationwide. I was privileged to be on it the other day. It also airs on the TBN network on television. Eric, it's so good to have you. Welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me. I feel honored to be with you, Frank. You're somebody I've respected and admired for a long, long time. If I can add anything to the program, I will be surprised, but that's your business.
Well, I'm confident of it, and I'm glad to have you on to test it. I want to start with a problem that we discussed on your program recently, and that is just weighing on me, and I think on our audience, a lot of Americans as well. Namely, the sense that something is seriously wrong in this country and certainly in the world. And I wondered if you would address it from the point of view of somebody who's been, you know, both deeply involved in the study of, the chronicling of, and the practice of spiritual faith, and the extent to which spiritual warfare may be part of what is wrong, what is wrong again, both domestically and internationally.
Well, I think we can start where Solzhenitsyn started, and he didn't even start there. He got it from old people who had said it. He quoted them when they were wondering what had happened, how had these things happened, meaning the Bolshevik Revolution and Stalin. And old people said that man has forgotten God. That is how all these things have happened. And I begin my new book, it's called Is Atheism Dead, with that quote, because I think the way things have kind of sifted out historically, recently, we're getting a clearer and clearer divide between those who have forgotten God and those who regard God with at least some sincerity, even if they aren't, you know, the kind of Christian I aspire to be, but who take the thesis of God, that there is a God, and that we are his creatures, who take that seriously. So I think how we get to where we are today, I think in America, for most of our history, we took that very seriously. You know, we put in God, we trust on our coins, you know, just about in our lifetimes, not much before you and I came into the world. it's not something from our distant past, but it's something that has been who we are. You know, Tocqueville was surprised to see it, because it's interesting when you think about Tocqueville and you think of France, let's say 240, 50 years ago, there was a secularism there that was at war with liberty. But in America, from our beginning till today, our liberty has, at least to some extent, come out of our faith in God. The strength of this country has been its churches, has been its places of worship. And I think what's happened, let's say, since the 60s, a lot of these, I wouldn't just say godless, but in some cases, anti-God ideas, ultimately, usually Marxist ideas, now culturally Marxist ideas, have found their way into American culture. And it's a few things are going on, but that's this kind of sifting that's been happening. So when you see tremendous loss of liberty in America, when you think, when you and I see things happening in America that you think, this maybe this could happen once in a blue moon in Canada or in Norway. It's happening all around the world in communist countries, but in America, no. Well, these things have been happening. Obviously, COVID has accelerated them, but ultimately, it's this kind of a sifting. One worldview, as I said, regards God as the ultimate authority. We look to Him. We have, you know, in the 18th century, they said we have no king but Jesus. So you can govern yourself if you look to a higher power ultimately as the authority, and then you say, well, I worry about what he thinks. I will govern myself. If you remove the higher power completely, then someone has to govern us. And that is what's been happening increasingly around the world, but of course, as we see in America as well.
Let me just inject this point, and it's implicit in what you said, but just to tease it out explicitly. Does this come down increasingly, as you see it, to a death struggle between good and evil? And the good may be imperfect, I think, and we all certainly are, but is there any question in your mind, Eric, that fundamentally the forces of good are under assault across the board? We're going to talk in a moment about Ukraine as a perhaps particular battlefield of the moment, but hardly the only one. Is that what's at foot in this spiritual warfare, as you said?
It's interesting because, I'm not just somebody who says I'm a Christian, which means I'm not a Jew or I'm not a Muslim or I'm not an atheist, whatever, but I take very seriously what the scriptures say. And I think we're obliged to, if you identify as some kind of a Christian, you're obliged to follow it all the way through. And what that means is that everything is ultimately spiritual. So the spiritual reality is the deeper reality, and politics and everything else are really just manifestations of the deeper spiritual reality. And I think that there are people who would not describe themselves, as I would, as some kind of an evangelical, people like Tucker Carlson and Naomi Wolf, who suddenly, when you solve for X, you say, well, you know what? This, what's happening, doesn't make sense unless I look over here. There's something spiritual going on. It's not too strong to use the word evil. When you're talking about tyranny, we're not talking about some fun, old-fashioned kind of tyranny. We're talking about a wickedness that you saw.
I love that thought, and I want you to freeze the frame. The fun kind of tyranny, we're going to come back to whether there's any evidence of that in this world at the moment, or whether what we're dealing with is, unfortunately, the most horrific kind of tyranny, and that is one that crushes spirituality, crushes faith, crushes the people who embrace it, Christians, of course, among them, most horrifically around the world at the moment. We're going to get into all of that and more in the context particularly of something Tucker Carlson has taken position on, Ukraine, with Eric Metaxas right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're continuing this really fascinating conversation with one of the most illuminating people I've ever met, Eric Metaxas, star of stage and screen, and our guest here at Securing America. Eric, you were talking about tyranny and the character of tyranny in our time and the extent to which it is truly evil and determined to destroy what is good. And that would include, I think, very much the United States of America, which stands for freedom and has sought to protect it elsewhere around the world as well as here at home. Finish that thought, if you would, and if you can, put this into a real world, real time context of Ukraine.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm not going to pretend that I have the Ukraine situation even slightly figured out. I'll just say what I know. First of all, I have been one of those who, since 1991, wondered exactly what was going on. In other words, if the Soviet Union collapses, I never really understood the idea of why we needed NATO. I wasn't one of those people who said we don't, or I'm against NATO. But it struck me then, to some extent, and increasingly so now, that there are, I guess today I would call them deep state actors. There are people in the United States government who don't see the world the way I do. They don't want American liberty to bless other nations, that we want to spread our freedom. They still see things maybe as a zero-sum game. Maybe the Cold War is profitable for them. I don't know. But what I do know is that they are cynical. And so I feel that part of how we got here, I mean, somebody has to say it once an hour, the reason I think Putin did what he did is simply because we have an unprecedentedly weak president projecting unprecedented weakness. And that what happens in those moments, whether it's in the jail, in jail or in the schoolyard, bullies take advantage of it. Tyrants take advantage of it. Bad actors take advantage of it. So that needs to be said first and foremost. What's that?
Evil takes advantage of it.
Well, there's no question that we have to be clear. Yes, we're talking about evil. So when you don't project strength, again, it's not just strength, but it's the kind of a strength that Jesus projected. It's a kind of authority that comes from God. It's not mere, I'm stronger than you, although maybe that's how, you know, the bullies read it. But I guess, so that's part of it. And that we would be crazy not to think that China is going to take its moment again, you know, to take advantage of us, because they see that now is the time to strike. We'd be fools not to strike. So that's very important. But I also think that, Ukraine has been used cynically by Americans in the way that we have done this, you know, going back, longer than I know, but, you know, into the 50s, that we really, it's one thing to talk about our own, about our self-interest, but it's another thing to cynically play with nations and with people. And so, I never really understood why we were wanting to expand NATO. And I say this out of genuine ignorance, but the point is the case, if when somebody doesn't make a case, I'm very, I become increasingly curious, and then I become skeptical. I say, what am I missing here? We know Putin's bad, but he's not Stalin, he's not Khrushchev, he's not Brezhnev. What am I missing? If somebody needs to make the case that yes, he is that, and he wants to, you know, recreate the Soviet Union, but when people don't make that case, I get confused, and then I mistrust our side, I guess.
Well, I just to calibrate, I guess, and this is why I was so anxious to talk with you, Eric, we've seen, I think, in the face of what's being done to Ukraine, evil, and that whether he's on a par with, the horrors of yesteryear, Joseph Stalin coming to mind as the man who literally starved to death millions of Ukrainians, or whether he's simply in our time somebody who is willing to use considerable military power to devastate a country that yearns to be part of the West and I think was a good candidate for it. And whether we should, in fact, regard it as, vital interest of the United States that they be part of the West, I think is a question that we'll probably be debating for years. But I do think where we find ourselves at this moment, and I just like your sort of closing thoughts on this, is if this is a function or a manifestation of spiritual warfare, and if good and evil are joined at the moment in this particular battle space, do you feel as though we have an obligation as a nation to, at the minimum, help those who are fighting for freedom in places like Ukraine and possibly places like Taiwan in the not too distant future, or maybe even India, if they wind up, as you say, being the next victims of totalitarian tyrannical aggression? And if so, do you think that this is really not simply an instance of doing something for somebody else, but vital to our own freedoms and interests here as well?
Yeah, I'll disappoint you by giving a firm "I don't know." And when I say "I don't know," what I mean by that is we have to ask ourselves, who is the United States? Is the United States the Biden administration and General Milley and others? I cannot be represented by those people. The United States, which is to say we the people, that's another story entirely. And I don't think it is we the people and the American founders' vision that brought about what is happening in Ukraine. It's as I said, the projected weakness of this country, our inability to deal with China, which you're an expert on this kind of stuff. And so I find myself being confused because I don't like the idea of our men and women in uniform doing the bidding of people that don't represent us. So in a sense, until we know who we are and what we stand for. In other words, if we in this country are for vaccine mandates, and if we in this country are for transgender madness, and if we are for playing patty cake with the evil in China, then I honestly find myself paralyzed to know what it is we are to do.
To which we're going to return as a result, because we both have thoughts on the subject and we need to share them. I think, Eric, thank you for your time today. Come back to us soon. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to do just that, that you'll visit us for more information at securingamerica.tv, and then go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.